sometimes people think, oh yeah, well, like, I puked a couple times in my pregnancy and so I had hyperemesis. No. Nope. It's a very, very different thing.
The worst thing I could ever imagine. I would never wish it upon my worst enemy. It makes me want to not have more children. I mean, it's just really, really, really terrible.
Depression, PTSD, suicidal ideation, extremely common in women with hyperemesis.
But imagine if you've ever had severe food poisoning, or imagine that every single day for like 5+ months.
Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I am your co-host, Dr. Morgan McDermott, and this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Leah and I share our natural women's health and motherhood guidance that you've been looking for through our fresh, functional, and balanced lens. And today I am talking all about hyperemesis gravidarum. So HG, sometimes just shortened to hyperemesis. This is a severe nausea and vomiting disorder of pregnancy. This is not morning sickness. This is not just somebody with extreme morning sickness. This is not just somebody who's needs to buck up and, you know, grin and bear it. Hyperemesis is a rare disorder that affects 3-5% of pregnant women worldwide and has a slew of sequelae, consequences, issues, and also treatment plans that are usually medication-based. So today we're going to talk about that. And I wish truly that I had some sort of amazing natural remedy for you all to take that would just take it away, and I don't. But we will talk about the nuance of the things that we do know that can help, some different strategies and things to keep in mind, especially with your postpartum recovery, maybe that you had not heard about. So if you or if anyone around you has been affected by HG in your lives, please share this episode with them. And also just know walking into this that it's going to really hopefully help to change your mindset and make you a little bit more empathetic for people who are going through this experience, because it's not an easy one. So here we go. Let's go ahead and dive in.
Okay, we are back to talk about another important part of pregnancy that can happen to a lot of women, which is severe nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, called hyperemesis gravidarum, right?
Gravidarum.
Potato, potato. Mm-hmm. But anyways, this is something that plagues women and can be incredibly challenging. And I had, I would say, a version of this. There's different intensities and extremisms along this spectrum, but I have a flavor of what it is like, and it is the worst thing I could ever imagine. I would never wish it upon my worst enemy. It makes me want to not have more children. I mean, it's just really, really, really terrible. And a lot of people don't know anything about it. They don't understand it. And so Dr. Morgan is going to explain just what is going on and what it means and how to diagnose it and the things that we can do, even though there's not much we can do. But why don't you take it away?
Okay, awesome. This has been a requested topic for a little while. And I wish that I'll just tell you right out the gate. I wish that I had something that was like, oh, there's this like gatekept remedy that I'm going to tell you that's going to blow your mind, that you've never heard of, that, you know, is going to change everything for you. But unfortunately, it isn't like that with hyperemesis. There are some ideas, of course, that we have that could maybe be a couple of points of your whole total pie, and they're important things to think of, but also they're really difficult things to enact sometimes for people who have hyperemesis. So you're just going to do the best that you can. But let's just talk about all of the different things that go into it and what it is exactly, because sometimes people think, oh yeah, well, like, I puked a couple times in my pregnancy and so I had hyperemesis. No, nope. It's a very, very different thing. And actually putting them on the same plane is very invalidating to people who've had hyperemesis, mm-hmm. because they're extremely different things. It is normal and common to be nauseous in the first trimester specifically, and probably, you know, up to maybe a fourth of the second trimester for most people. And it just be normal pregnancy nausea, pregnancy, you know, morning sickness kind of thing. And whether or not you puke is whatever. But this is luckily rare, thank goodness. It's a rare and debilitating disorder that causes an inability to eat or drink normally. And causes strong limitations on your daily living activities. So it's going to completely stop you in your tracks. It's not like you just live with hyperemesis and are as able to do things. Some people probably do a little bit, if maybe especially if you're forced, but it's not something that is like a small deal. People are often hospitalized for a long period of time. But so let's just talk about some of the diagnosis too, because you're like, well, what if I have it? I don't know if that's what you're thinking. So you're usually diagnosed with questionnaires by your doctor, and there's things like some principles and some general matters. And this is what Leo was saying about, you had a flavor of it, or you had like maybe a part of the spectrum of it, because there is going to still be people who are maybe not quite exactly within this bounds of the diagnostic criteria, but they're still way more severe than just like regular morning sickness. So part of the criteria is that you lose between 3 and 5% of your body weight, and that you're having 3 or more vomits per day. That's kind of like one of the bigger ways to look at it. There's a lot of other things that go into it, but that is the general thing. But some of the signs and symptoms for you that you'd be experiencing that would lead to that kind of weight loss too is that you have debilitating chronic nausea, frequent vomiting of bile and even sometimes blood. You're in like a chronic dehydrated state, and you may even go into ketosis, which is when, like, if you do not have enough glucose, your body will start to burn fat to create it, so that you have, or you so that you have fuel making ketones, so that your brain and your organs don't shut down. We talk about ketosis nowadays in like the fasting world, and it's like a healthy state of being. It's not when you're pregnant. It is not okay when you're pregnant. Muscle weakness and extreme fatigue, again, because of your lack of electrolytes, everything in your body is getting messed up. I mean, like, not to be more, people can die from this. Like, it can be a very, very extreme disorder. You have an inability to care for yourself and especially others, like to even just shower and prepare food or try to eat food. There's extreme, incredible weakness with it. And like with the weight loss, as we said, or very little gain. Sometimes that can be part of the criteria as well. And then there's usually this, like, it's right out the gate in first trimester. It's not like it starts later. It would be something that is affecting you immediately. And by like 14 weeks, like into your second trimester, you're still unable to eat or drink very well. Now, some people will have some resolution of their symptoms, maybe not completely, but maybe like in a very significant way, where at the end of their second trimester or for their third trimester, they're feeling a lot better and a lot more normal. But that first trimester is an extremely debilitating medical health event. It's not just normal pregnancy nausea. And the stats, luckily, are that this only affects between 1 and 3% of pregnancies worldwide. Whereas then, like, 90% of women are going to experience some level of like morning sickness. Okay,
Yeah,
but
I feel like
yeah.
it's confusing because there might be people listening who maybe don't meet that criteria, kind of like me. Like I did lose, I think I lost about 3% of my body weight and I didn't gain much, but I only vomited once a day, not 3 times a day. But my nausea was so extreme, I couldn't feed myself, I couldn't take care of myself, and I was like very impacted. So I technically wouldn't meet the diagnostic criteria for HG, but I feel like what I experienced was much more extreme than what is normal morning sickness. So
Right.
for anybody who's listening who maybe falls in that criteria where they're like, I felt like I had HG, like it was so severe. I got IVs, I had to do all sorts of stuff, but I didn't vomit 3 times a day or whatever. Like I just want to validate you that you might still have an experience like this, but it might not be as extreme as this super severe extreme version of it. So,
Yeah, because you were still unable to eat or drink anything, or like, so the although you're not losing bile and blood from a mechanical vomit situation, you weren't intaking and you were dying
I mean,
in other ways.
I threw up every single day, some days twice a day, but not 3 times a day. I didn't have enough food and I couldn't eat anything. So there was
Right.
nothing to even throw up.
I
I don't know
know.
how someone with HG even throws up 3 times a day. I mean, I would gag and stuff, but it's like there
It's
wouldn't be a
bile.
lot
It's
coming
like,
out.
yeah, like there's like this hypersensitive reaction to it. So HG is the most common reason for early pregnancy hospital admission too, far and above miscarriage or ectop, any of those kinds of reasons. And then there's some risk factors. So people always want to know, like, oh my God, am I going to get it? Or if they've maybe had it with one pregnancy and then they're worried about getting it again. So that's that one. We'll talk about that. But so let's That is like the number one risk factor. So let's just go there. The largest number one risk factor is having a pregnancy with HG prior. Would you say you had it with Avi, or it wasn't as bad with her, or was it?
Oh yeah. Yeah,
Oh, same
just as
thing.
bad. Yep,
Okay.
just as bad.
Oh
Couldn't
gosh,
do
I'm so
anything, couldn't
sorry.
eat, threw up every day. Yeah, it was bad. I mean, I was like suicidal, you know. It was bad.
Yeah,
With
we'll
both of
talk about
them.
that too.
Cade was a little bit worse, but not, I mean, it was, they were both equally really bad.
And yeah, we were living in the same state when you were pregnant with Evie because that was COVID in
Yeah.
California. Yeah, so I didn't really see that.
That's right. I've blocked out my entire pregnancy with her. I'm trying to think back on like where I even was.
Yeah, you were in Encinitas, but the world was on
How
fire,
funny.
and then you were barely surviving pregnancy, so it was
Oh
probably a really
yes,
bad time.
I lived in my Hermes house. Oh, I was so depressed there. Yeah, I remember that. I just laid on my couch and was so sad and depressed. Yep, I remember. Wow. Yep.
Oh.
And then when we were trying to buy a house, I was like the middle of my second trimester and I was like vomiting every time we went to like look at a house. I was like throwing up everywhere. Sorry.
Oh,
It's like,
gosh.
yeah, so I remember, it's coming back to me now. Yep.
It's all
Yeah.
coming back. It's all
Yeah,
coming back to me
because I was like, I
now.
don't remember throwing up in my Hilltop house because we
You
got
were.
into the Hilltop house after my first two trimesters. I was like in my third, I think.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. That
And
adds
that
up to me.
house, that Hermes house, had mold, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably a confounding factor.
Yeah, I think a lot of mine was histamine related. I don't know if they found any of that with HG, histamine
It could be.
correlation.
Yeah, it's kind of like, so if you guys have ever heard us talk about, I don't know if we've talked about it that much, but histamine in early first trimester, or just in general first trimester, is one of the proposed theories of why it causes women to be nauseous and vomit in within like the realm of normal morning sickness, because of the placenta making a lot more histamine, and then our liver having a bit of a hard time catching up to create the enzyme that is going to break down the histamine that's called DAO. So you can take a DAO supplement, a DAO enzyme supplement. Seeking Health creates one. And they actually have a really good blog on their website that's all about this. If you type in, like, literally just go to Google, type in DAO histamine pregnancy Seeking Health, and it'll pop up. And you can read all about it. And, the rates of increasing and stuff. And I'm sure that there is a part of that that would be helped in an HG. But again, the etiology, and we'll talk about it, is going to be mostly from this like sort of genetic. Yeah. Here, okay, we'll get there. Let me
Yeah,
talk about the
we'll
risk
get
factors
there.
first. So,
Perfect.
having had a history of HG is the biggest risk factor. If you've had it before, you're 89% chance on average likely to get it again. So that's going to be very disheartening to hear for some people, and I'm so sorry because it's like looking at the belly of a beast, and knowing that you're going into that again if you want to have more children. One of our close friends, Lisa, has had HG experiences in the past, and she's such a wonderful person to talk to about it. It would have been probably good to get her on this episode. Dang it. Oops. Okay, having a family history of it, other women in your family, because again, there's this genetic component, gene-based. It being your first pregnancy is a risk factor. Having multiples in your pregnancy, so you're pregnant with twins or something. Having the baby be a female increases your risk. Being younger in your maternal age, which is
Interesting.
weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Being extremely overweight or extremely underweight. Okay, so any extreme there. And then this is where there's this GDF15 growth factor, growth differentiation factor gene that plays this role. And we're going to talk more about that in the future because it's not like you go and you get tested for that, but we'll discuss it. So some of the consequences, this is the way that I have my outline broken down here, the consequences for the mother, and then we'll talk about consequences for the baby of HG. So this is not to shame anybody or to, it's just facts. This is just the disorder. And I don't want it to scare anybody, but I also think informed consent is important so that you know that if this is happening to you, that you need to get the support you need, and
Yeah.
not just like let it go on, because there are things that are negatives associated with it. And it's, it makes sense, right? It's logical. If you're not having any nutrition given to your body, pretty much, or you're throwing everything up, that are we physically can't, we just don't thrive in that. And so then there's going to probably be repercussions. So this is a some of them for the maternal side. The general insufficiency of nutrients and calories and your weight loss and your nutrient deficiencies. But there are some specific ones that can be really scary. Like there's Wernicke's encephalopathy, which is from a B1 deficiency, which is called thiamine. So thiamine is B1. And when we don't get any B1 from our diet or our supplements, we can have a brain swelling. It's called Wernicke's encephalopathy. Low thiamine, even in and of itself, actually can cause more nausea and vomiting. So this is one of those like cyclical factors. So supplementing with B1 is a really common integrative approach to somebody's hyperemesis treatment plan. Specifically, like if you can't take any other kind of supplement or pill, it would be like at least there's B1 in there. In rare cases, vitamin K deficiency also, which can cause like maternal hemorrhage or even neonatal intracranial hemorrhage, which means that the baby is having like essentially a stroke inside of you because they're having a brain bleed during their fetal development because there is not enough clotting factor vitamin K in mom's blood because she's not getting it from diet. She's not able to feed her good bacteria in her gut that's going to be creating it too. And so the whole system, but this is rare. That one's not as common. Some other sequelae or different repercussions that can happen is that there's hospital admissions. And so women with there, if you have had at least one hospital admission, there's an increased risk of, this is kind of like a finding, a correlation that they found. There's an increased risk of blood clotting during the pregnancy, birth, or postpartum.
Interesting.
At some point for the mom. Of course, dehydration,
Because
which
of the hospital admission, like something happens there, or because they're so severe
I
that it
think it's probably
required a
because
hospital admission.
because they're so severe, it's like that's their marker for severity of HG, and that they think, okay, probably then, which is interesting, right? Because it's like somehow there's a clotting risk and there's somehow a vitamin K bleeding out risk simultaneously. So there must be something maybe about the stagnation, maybe because you're laying down and you're not moving and
That would
you're at
make
risk for
sense.
clots and those kinds of ways. I don't know. Dehydration, if we get into a severe enough state of dehydration, we can have acute kidney injury or we can have cardiac arrhythmias because of low potassium. So our heart and our kidneys don't like it when we don't have good proper hydration. And so things like that can happen. Of course, then now we have stuff going on with the placenta. You're likely more likely to have a placental abruption or preeclampsia, especially if this is persisting into the second trimester and continuing with lack of being able to get your body really good nutrition. There's a higher rate of fetal loss. So the typical rate of fetal loss is 1 in 4. Or, for miscarriage, if you have hyperemesis, it's 1 in 3. So your stats are higher that direction. Then there's this idea of refeeding syndrome, which can happen from when you go from starving and you weren't eating, and then maybe you suddenly are feeling better or something is starting to happen. When you start to eat again, you just have to be very careful in how you're doing it. Because of these rapid electrolyte shifts, there can be cardiac issues. Like, they say if you find like a stray dog or something like that that's very skinny and hasn't been eating, you have to feed it very slowly. You can't just like let it go to town, because there can actually be issues with that if they've had a very long period of time of not eating. Things like jaundice, rhabdo, acute renal failure, muscle wasting, then of course all of the negative mental health repercussions, the anxiety, the depression, PTSD, suicidal ideation, extremely common in women with hyperemesis. It's a day in and day out, all day while you're sleeping, all every single moment that you are awake, you feel horrible and terrible. And of course that would cause depression. And it feels endless. And it's like, how is this going to, these babies are really usually pretty wanted, but there is also way more termination of pregnancy in hyperemesis situations, which again makes sense because sometimes it feels like you're literally going to die. And sometimes people literally are if they don't terminate. So that's a really sad, what's it called? Like, thing to face. A sad aspect of this is that somebody who may never, ever have gotten a termination in any other normal situation is may face that kind of a choice in this, and it causes a lot of shame and guilt and sequelae to it. And at the same time, my perspective on that would be you it, it's this is you wanted this baby. This is like, if you are the vessel growing it and you are literally dying because of it and you cannot cope and get through, then you guys would both die anyway. But also it's just like, what are you going to do? Especially if you have other kids and stuff. Like I don't know. I just, hopefully that's validating. I don't want this to contribute to shame in any way. Obviously, like my point and my goal here is to say, like, I get it. Like that makes sense, you know? As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I want to share an underrated tip with you. That tip is to continue taking your prenatal. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women stop taking their prenatal after birth, but we recommend taking it for at least the first 9 months postpartum or the entirety of the time that you're breastfeeding. My favorite prenatal is Needed's Prenatal Multi, and it's the most robust formula that I've seen in the market. It contains bioavailable nutrients in their evidence-based dosages, well above the bare minimum that a lot of prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are top tier with transparent third-party testing, and over 10,000 practitioners now recommending the brand. And now we have the results from their IRB-approved clinical study that confirm the results of what we've been seeing clinically. Women who take the prenatal multi have significantly higher blood levels of critical nutrients for pregnancy and postpartum. This includes vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, vitamin K2. Only women in the Needed group reach the adequate, sufficient levels of vitamin D. Vitamin D plays a big role in your immune health, your mood, and your energy production, all things that are really important during your postpartum season. And while there's many different ways that you can support yourself postpartum, continuing to take your prenatal is a really simple, easy way to cover all your bases. It's one of the most impactful habits that we can have, and Needed makes it easy. Learn more about the study at thisisneeded.com/thrive and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Yes, healthy mother, like a little affirmation for yourself.
Oh yeah,
Do you want to
I
speak to that about the
totally understand
mental
that. I
health?
mean, yeah, I again, it's like I don't think I would have been considered like the most extreme HG, but I feel like I was on a spectrum of that, and I'm normally a very positive, very happy person, can get through a lot of hard stuff, can handle a lot of pain and things like that, and it's this the experience I had during pregnancy was unlike anything I've ever had to deal with, and I was for sure suicidal. I mean, you get to a point where it's like I literally can't do this anymore, you know, because when you're not in a pregnancy, you know, 5 months of having extreme debilitating nausea and vomiting doesn't sound like that much, but imagine if you've ever had severe food poisoning or you were like really, really, really sick. To the point where you're like, I feel like I'm dying. Like, I need to go to the hospital. Something is not right. You're vomiting your brains out. You feel so sick. And it usually lasts like 1 to maybe 3 days. Imagine that every single day for like 5+ months.
No.
Every single day. I mean, you just can't function. And it feels like it will never end. Like, I remember when I was like 13 or 14 weeks. That's what, 2.5 months, you're just like, I'm so early. I have 9 months of a pregnancy. Like, this is never gonna end. You know, it just feels so hopeless and nothing helps. Like, no medication helps it. Nothing touches it. And then you're just like, and I think probably the lack of the nutrients affect your mental health even more.
Oh yeah, and then you're dehydrated, you're low blood sugar. I mean, it's all the things.
It's like all the things. So it makes it even worse. And so, yeah, I understand the termination desire, especially in certain circumstances when HG is so bad that it literally is life-threatening. And I understand the suicidal ideation. Like, it's no joke. You know, if someone is dealing with this, if you are not someone who's dealt with it, like, please have so much compassion for them because it's an invisible illness to some degree. You know, I mean, obviously, you can see them throwing up and you can see them not eating, but I just don't think people understand how debilitating it is and the constantness of it. You know, for someone who has disordered eating and they're choosing not to eat at certain times and losing weight, or maybe they, you know, are choosing to vomit and different things outside of pregnancy, that has its own set of repercussions. But this is so, like, the nausea attached with it, I don't know. It's terrible. So I just want to validate anyone who's had this experience. And also for anyone who doesn't understand, like, please just have so much grace and compassion for people who are struggling with this.
Yeah, it's not like a, oh, just grin. Like, you just need to have grit
Yeah,
and
just grin
mental
and bear it.
resilience.
Just like, it's not like a painful thing where you're like, you know, you break your leg or, you know, you have whatever. And it's like, you can just get through it. You can get through hard stuff. It is so much worse. I remember talking to a guy in the military who's been through everything. He's been shot, he's been tortured, he's been like all of the things. And he has had some experience, I can't remember exactly what it was, of severe nausea. And he said of all the things he's been through, of all of the horrible, the worst things that any soldier could go through, he's like, the constant, unrelenting nausea and vomiting of whatever it was that he was experiencing, I can't remember. He's like, that was the worst among all of it. Being shot, being tortured, being like, all of it. And I was like, I get that. I would so much rather be shot.
Wow.
Like,
yeah, because it's not like a, yeah, like,
it's not like pain.
Yeah. It's overall sickness. It's like you're just like, I would imagine hungover feeling, right? Like, but like, so yeah, intense.
It's like hungover times 1,000 that never, ever, ever stops. And then you can't eat. It's not like when you're hungover and you're like, oh, I just want to crave, I just need pizza. Like, I'm just going to eat some pizza and feel better. It's like, you cannot eat. You do not want to eat. You feel so sick. It's like there's no, but then you have to eat because you're weak and you're tired and like,
and then you know you're growing a baby, so you have this guilt.
Yeah,
you,
like, it's a really effed up thing. It's just
yeah.
So I just want to validate anyone who's going through it. And like I said, there are people with way worse than ever than I had. So I can't even imagine. My hat goes off to you. It's just so hard. And if you are someone who's had to terminate a pregnancy, please don't feel any shame because I get it. And it, like to for a woman who wants a baby to drive them to that level of, you know, it's beyond anything you could probably ever imagine. Like, please don't judge them.
Yeah. And especially like men having their opinions about things like that, or women who've never experienced it. Like, you just don't have a place to say that those people shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
If you're saving your own life, it's, couldn't you understand? I don't know. To me, it's like so very, I understand. Yeah, those women are not doing this willy-nilly. They're not doing it with a cold heart because they're like, oh, oops, this is my birth control. Like, they're not doing it in that way. It's like I want to have a baby, and oh, my body is having this almost like a reaction, which we'll talk about the GDF-15 thing. And it's very sad. So anyways, okay, we're not going to harp that point, but I'm just hoping that anyone shaking their head right now, it can just like loosen up a little bit and have some compassion. So, okay, let's talk about repercussions on the fetal side of things, which again, I mean, like, I know this isn't all fun to hear, but it's real and it's true that you would have a baby that would be associated more with a low birth weight. Having a baby early, so going into preterm labor, having a baby that spends some time in the NICU, or having a baby that maybe has the greater need for resuscitation, again, because they're probably just going to be born a little too early, a little too small. You know, they've been cooking amongst this like very tough situation as best as they can. Mm-hmm. We also see less issues like big babies that are, you know, getting stuck. But we also see less stillbirth, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. Women who have hyperemesis pregnancies, yes, have less stillbirth rates. Very fascinating. In those babies, once they're like out of the newborn phase, we do see some more things like colic, reflux, fussiness, some sensory processing disorders in these kids, anxiety, sleep issues in those babies born to mothers with HG. But overall, the impact isn't like anything extremely massive. It's those are a lot of those retrospective studies where they're asking in surveys, you know, was your baby fussy? Did you have colic and things like that? So there's not like a, oh my gosh, you can't do this because they're going to be born with some really extreme disorder.
Right. For the most part, baby pulls what baby needs and mom is
from you. Yes. And you will suffer even more. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about what causes it. So historically, actually, there used to be this thought that it was from psychological guilt because it showed that the woman had sex. And this is like in the 50s, the 40s and 50s.
Oh my gosh.
That like physically being pregnant was showing that she'd had sex as if it was like the worst thing in the whole world. And so this vomiting thing was their guilt coming out. And
oh my God.
Isn't that so crazy?
And that's not that long ago.
I know.
There are still people alive today that lived then.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that nuts?
In that mentality, that's crazy.
So it's not caused. Here, but we do know that it's not caused by stress or trauma, although women do experience those secondary side effects of stress and trauma, and isolation and trauma, or fear of death, hopelessness, frustration. There's a lot of psychological associations, but it's not caused by that. So you being like, oh, go relax, it's not going to help. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's really, they think the main thing is this interplay of the production of a protein that comes from the gene of the same name, which is GDF15, growth differentiation factor 15. So there's a gene that we have that will make and produce this protein that has this. The gene's called GDF15, the protein's called GDF15, and it's made by the placenta as well. And it goes to the brain and it suppresses appetite and it increases nausea just as a general thing. That is like sort of what it does. But people who have hyperemesis seem to make way, way, way more, way too much of this. And the receptor sits in the brainstem and it's called GFARAL. Receptor gene, in case you ever wanted to know that, or that's the receptor. And it triggers nausea, it triggers food aversions, and it triggers vomiting pathways. And so it's like there's two different things going on. We're making more of the protein, and then our receptor is also detecting it, and they think that there's a bit of a receptor sensitivity as well. There's another gene that's called IGF-BP7. That seems to maybe be associated, but there is pretty good research in the literature about GDF15 and associations of HG risk. And so when they've tested women who've had it, they're like, oh, this is really interesting. There seems to be a high production in the placenta specifically of this, like too much, and it's just going rampant and it's causing all of these problems. Electrolytes are trending, yes, but they have been in need of our human bodies for all of time. And if you're drinking another popular and delicious salty electrolyte, here's why you should be drinking Relight instead. First of all, have you ever considered the salt source of these other brands? Because most of them just use table salt. Yeah, table salt. You don't want that. Redmond's Relight Powders uses their unrefined ancient sea salt that they mine in Utah. This salt source contains 60 plus trace minerals along with calcium, chloride, potassium, and magnesium in two different forms, glycinate and malate. The minerals that they use in the Relight Powders are all in the appropriate proportions and forms, too. The metabolic needs of pregnancy, healing postpartum, and milk making require more minerals than in other times of your life. Pregnancy itself demands huge increases in your blood volume, which takes, more minerals. Relight is the perfect blend to be sipping during your pregnancy or during your labor even, and especially while you're breastfeeding. It tastes amazing, and my favorite flavors oscillate between mixed berry, lemon lime, and the strawberry lemonade. But you can try a sample pack and try all the flavors for yourself and see what you think. Use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% on your entire Redmond order. That includes their OG sea salt, other seasonings, bentonite clays, toothpaste, and more.
So it's produced by the placenta. So this is not something you could test before pregnancy to see if you are going to be somebody who makes a lot of it.
That's a really good question because it's something that would maybe be seen. Well, maybe they could test her receptor part of it. That's a good question. I don't actually know.
I want to know if I have this. It's so interesting.
Let me find, see if I can find out. There also is a really good documentary about hyperemesis that I just want to mention that I didn't earlier that's called Sick, The Battle Against HG, and it's on Amazon. There also is a foundation called the HER Foundation, but it's just hyperemesis.org. And then there's also a website that we're going to put in the show notes that's a blog on some homeopathics to start to trial and error. Again, low expectation of them working, probably. Potentially working with a homeopath would be better, and you could maybe get some more specifics that way, but anyways, okay, so I'm looking this up right now. It does not seem that you can test for, it's just not going to be a common thing to test for GDF15. And there is, your body does make some of it, but the placenta is what makes they think, at least they think, the like huge storm. That was like a cytokine storm, but it's just this gigantic production of this protein that is wreaking havoc on the brain by making you just feel absolutely terrible.
Got it.
Also, this protein has been known in cancer patients because we do make it ourselves. In cancer patients, if you have a higher level of GDF15, you have a higher chance of cachexia, which is like a muscle wasting and muscle loss disease, aspect of this that can happen. Sometimes people tank out really quickly because of cachexia specifically. And it's not just, oh yeah, I was sick, I wasn't able to eat and stuff like that. It's like, no, this is a component of it sometimes where it's causing this rapid breakdown of your body tissues. There's also a progesterone receptor and an insulin-like growth factor binding protein 7 that are maybe implicated. They also think that there's some women who have high serum thyroxine levels, which you do, right?
Of thyroxine, yeah, higher thyroid.
Yeah, so they find that in up to 73% of women who have hyperemesis, that they have some period at some point in their pregnancy where they're having a really high thyroxine level.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate because, like this is saying, the GDF-1 decreases appetite, and so you don't really necessarily want to eat. And then when you have high thyroid, your body's burning through calories faster, so the need for eating is greater. So it's
Yeah.
like a perfect storm. I just looked this up while we're talking though, because I was wondering if the GDF-15 has anything to do with mast cells. Because mast cells are a type of immune cell that are released in allergies, and they're very connected to histamine. Mast cells are what make histamine, and it does say that it is mechanically linked to mast cells. So it doesn't mean that anyone who has mast cell syndrome would have hyperemesis, but that there does seem to be some connection that they
Connection.
are like connected somehow, because that's something that I've wondered. And I know that there's a Chinese medicine doctor here in Idaho who has said that he's had success in helping women who've had pretty severe nausea feel better. I don't know if what his rate is with hyperemesis, but you know, Chinese medicine works on so many pathways and like unique ways of helping things like mast cells or histamines and stuff in a way that even naturopathic medicine we don't have a ton of amazing things for. So that is just really interesting to me that I wonder if there is another pathway that could be, you know, supported, because the mast cell syndrome and just understanding mast cells is not very well understood in the conventional model. So if they're not doing that kind of research, they wouldn't know it. But in the more functional world, I wonder if there's a lot of, if there's any connection there that could be supported.
Yeah, that's really interesting because that would be just like a double whammy. Now you're getting this histamine side of things and the GDF15. There is another like main thought of etiology, which is just like a sort of a, and maybe it's just connected in some kind of other way, or maybe for some women, it's like a smaller percentage of them that this is the main way. We don't really know. I mean, here's the end of the day is that we're trying to figure it out, but it's rare and it's not easy to try to figure this out. But there is this gastric dysfunction etiology, meaning like the cause of the disease. But the main kind of chunk of it is this GDF15 protein, it seems. But the gastric dysfunction one would be like, you know, because you're fasting and you're having this low protein intake, there's slow GI movement, and then that's causing this like bloating and low appetite, constipation, like everything's slow. I mean, progesterone as it rises is also having its effect on the GI system to slow things down. Maybe there's more acid reflux. There is a little bit of H. pylori thought too that a lot of women who do have hyperemesis have H. pylori when they've tested. But it's like, well, is that chicken or the egg though? Do they have it because it, you know, everything in the gut has been halted and isn't working properly, and then now it's been able to proliferate and grow? It could be a risk factor though. If I was somebody who'd had an HG pregnancy and I was having another one, I would probably test myself for H. pylori. Might as well get rid of it before you get pregnant again. It doesn't serve you in any way. It's only negative anyways. It's a pathological bacteria of the stomach that we don't want to be there. Pretty easy to get it tested. Breath test, go to your doctor, your functional medicine doctor or your naturopathic doctor. Because it could be partly a thing. And so maybe it's 10% of the cog in your wheel. So you have a 10% less severe HG. Do you see what I'm saying? So, okay. And so then, yeah, we've already talked about the recurrence rate. So 50 to 80% recurrence rate, but they landed somewhere at like kind of 89 was, or if you've had it once, yeah, 89% chance of getting it again. But then, of course, there's going to be people who don't. Some of the normalization of the difficulty, as we were talking about before, 52% of people with HG consider termination due to the HG. 5 to 15% of the pregnancies actually do end in termination. So a lot more of them think about it than do it. But it's like they can't work, they can't take care of their other children, their life completely stops. It's not like, oh, you're just nauseous. Like, I really need to hound that home. That point home. It is like all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's like you had a terminal illness that for 3 months, okay, you just don't do anything, and, or potentially more than 3 months. Okay, you're just in the hospital getting IVs and like yakking and being extremely depressed and like just grin and bear it, work through it. Haha, you're making a baby. It's like, no, sometimes people cannot do that. Like, can't we understand that? I don't know. I just get so riled up because I know there's going to be people who are like, well, it's wrong. You just don't do it. And it's like, yeah, you know what? I'm sure that you've like, what else is wrong that you've done in your life? Everybody has the, yeah, maybe they know that it's wrong. They don't want to do it, but it's like you maybe have to. I don't know. We have an abortion episode where I talk about it with Nathan Riley, talk about different aspects of abortion because I feel like there's a big, not trying to make this episode all about abortion, but it just really frustrates me when people cannot possibly have compassion for any of the potential reasons why people would maybe do it. I think there's a misconception that people think that the main reason that people have an abortion is for like because they were lazy and that they just got pregnant. And I know that that does happen too. And yeah, I don't agree with that either. Like I don't. And it's not something I would do, but I can see why there are situations that it would be the choice for other people, and this is definitely one of them. So, and then 25% of women with hyperemesis consider suicide, and oh, occasionally. So 25% of them consider it occasionally, and 7% of them consider it regularly. And it was hard to find stats on how many of them carry out suicide, but it does happen. And so, okay, let's talk about treatment plans, which are going to be heavily pharmaceutical based. And this is sort of just one of those situations where you elevate your care to pharmaceutical use because the natural stuff is great at addressing root cause or chronic things, or sometimes it can be really helpful for symptomatic relief. But in this situation, you're unlikely to get a lot of benefit from the natural world. And I mean, it's hard for me to say that, but it's just true. So I wish that there could be, and homeopathy can be really awesome, but it's just not realistic for everybody to wait and have these appointments with a homeopath and do all the different things. So I don't know. I maybe you're working
I
with a
mean,
homeopath.
even me, I mean, I would consider myself a pretty good homeopath, and I mean, nothing worked, you know? So maybe some people do have success for sure, but it's not a guarantee, and you're not a failure if you have to take meds. I mean, I remember feeling that way during my pregnancy, but it's like sometimes you just have to.
Did you take any meds? I can't remember.
Oh yeah, I took Unisom, and
Oh, okay.
it didn't help that much, but
Okay.
it would cut my nausea maybe from like 95% to like 70%. It was enough
Okay.
to help. It was enough to help me. Like it was helpful enough, but I didn't start it until like 12 weeks because I was just trying to push out and do as much as I could, and just I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah. And that's an antihistamine route. So we'll talk about that. Okay. So the kind of the main, well, the big one is for most people, some sort of a serotonin antagonist. These are considered pregnancy class B, and they're found to work in about 80% of people with HG. And that's gonna be your Zofrans, Kytryl, mirtazapine. But Zofran is the big one, and Zofran has a bad rap because of there can be some deep, problems with the baby. And sometimes when we're looking at the intersection of like life and death, what do you do? Maybe you in your way want to say, I'm gonna try all this other stuff first and then we'll go there if we absolutely need to. And that's a totally reasonable choice and situation. But Zofran also does save a lot of people. So it's not always something that we need to be against. In my perfect world for all women with HG, they would try other things first. Yes.
Yeah, and I'm not a fan of Zofran for women who just have normal pregnancy nausea and vomiting. I
Yeah,
think
no.
that's very much recommended. Like even when I was trying to get nurses to come give me IVs, they're like, "Oh, do you just want some Zofran?" Like it's so casual. Like they would just give it to you like it's candy. And it's like, "Do you know like the implications of this?" So
Yeah.
there are better meds than others to try first. Obviously, it's a ladder that we climb up, but it's not something that is without risk.
Yes, exactly. And so that is kind of the big heavy hitter. I always wanted to just start with that because it does work in a lot of people. But ideally, if we can do some of these other things, so let's talk about what could those other things be. So sometimes bed rest, IV fluids, and nutritional therapy can be some of the most effective things, like warm IV fluids. So you're doing this like either at an outpatient clinic or maybe if you are hospitalized, or maybe you have somebody that you can get to come to your house to do IVs, which Lisa, our friend who I mentioned earlier, she really had a plan the second time she got pregnant. And when she got there, her second pregnancy was twins. So she was in a much, even more precarious situation with that, but IV fluids really, really helped her too with that. So you can find a practitioner that's going to do these. You want them to be really good at what they're doing with their venipuncture so that they're going to preserve your veins because you might be getting a lot of pokes during this pregnancy. Using warm blankets, using non-oral antiemetics and vitamins, like it could be sublingual or a sub-Q or either vaginal or rectal, because any kind of thing going into the mouth sometimes will trigger people to vomit. So you can take an antiemetic is an anti-vomiting medication, but you're just taking it in a different route. If you have mild HG, then the antihistamines could be the thing that all you need to do. So that could be your Unisomms or your, and for you, it's not that you had mild HG. I'm not trying to say that. I'm just saying that, like,
Yeah, no.
for people who have mild, this may be all you need to do.
Yeah.
Your Dramamine, your Diclegis, which is really the only approved medication for HG. Diclegis is what it's called. And it's a mix of an antihistamine plus a B6
Yeah.
or Benadryl, something like that. Those are all sort of like pregnancy class A or B. For mild or moderate HG, there you can take an anti-dopaminergic, but those are pregnancy class C. So that's a little bit in the less ideal category, even below Zofran. If they think that some of what's going on with you is primarily from a gastric point of view, you can do things like gastric pacing. You can take acid reducing meds. You can take a medication that will increase your peristalsis, so increase the movement of your gut so that it's just like going through quicker and things are not just sitting there. And then doing like maybe liquid diets, like high protein liquid diets, things like that. So there's a lot of things you can kind of mess around with. And then there's the mental emotional piece as a secondary that sometimes needs to be treated with a medication forward approach as well.
Yeah.
So the
And I'll
top
just throw
five,
in
oh, go.
here. Oh, sorry. I mentioned it previously, but I think it is worth it if you have HG and you're at the extreme place of, deciding life or death, deciding on Zofran, these kind of things. It might be worth trying like Chinese medicine herbs. I know a lot of people say, oh, you can't take Chinese medicine herbs when you're pregnant, but in China, they have been doing it for thousands of years with no re negative repercussions on the baby. So if you find a really good TCM, Chinese medicine practitioner who does a lot with herbs, who has helped, nausea with women and stuff, they often feel very comfortable with it. And personally, it might be like a less negative effect on your baby, these herbs, even if we don't know that much about them, from like a double-blind placebo-controlled trial standpoint, from a historical standpoint. And they might really, really help you, especially if there's a gastric thing going on, if there is any sort of histamine or mast cell thing going on, because they just work in a very different way than just a single agent mechanism like some of these medications do, and can maybe get to the root cause of certain things. So I, now that I know that, I didn't know that as much during my pregnancies, I would potentially consider that either before you get pregnant again, working with someone, and or even during your pregnancy, obviously working with someone who knows it well, but that's another thing to just know about.
There's many brands of botanical or herbal medicines to choose from, and one of my favorites right now for the season of motherhood is Earthly. One major benefit of using plant-derived supplements is that you get the synergistic effects of all of the compounds that the plant has to offer instead of just one single compound, because they are meant to work together. And then beyond that, the geniuses at Earthly have combined plants in such a smart way to complement each other. Like with the Nourish Her Naturally tincture, which is almost like a Nora tea, the pregnancy tea that's nettle, oat, red raspberry, and alfalfa, but it's in a tincture form. This Nourish Her Naturally tincture also contains dandelion, catnip, and spearmint to also increase your mineral and antioxidant intake in pregnancy while you are still benefiting from the nervous system effects and all of the different things that each plant has to offer, and then the way that each plant works together synergistically. Earthly has a magnesium lotion for your calves and feet at night in case they start cramping, a mama's tummy relief tincture to aid in nausea, and then postpartum support herbs like Ease the Ache tincture to help with the pain of afterbirth contractions, which, if you've never felt those, my goodness. They also carry an herbal sitz bath blend that you can make into peri pads, put in your peri bottle, do a traditional sitz bath, or something like a yoni steam with. For all your motherhood needs and your pediatric needs, head to earthly.com to check out their huge collection of effective herbal remedies, and then you can use the code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 10% off your order. So again, head to earthly.com because nature is medicine. Yeah, I wouldn't. I would definitely call around in your area and see if there's somebody who feels like more comfortable, because potentially an average acupuncturist is gonna it's gonna be too far
No.
extreme for
It
their
would be someone
wheelhouse.
who like does this, who like
Right.
does Chinese medicine herbs for these
Right.
extreme situations. Yeah, like I know
Yeah,
this
so
one here
then
in Idaho.
kind of have that like in the in your back pocket as you're maybe
Yeah.
managing all this. And maybe it can be, again, it's like maybe you can get to a point where if you were feeling 10 out of 10, you can get to the point where you're feeling like 6 or 7 out of 10 instead. So the top five medications strategies from the hyperemesis.org website would be things like hydration regularly with IV multivitamins. So like not just saline, but you're also getting, you know, specifically B vitamins in those IVs as you are rehydrating. And then to have a mindset of like experimentation. So to change the dose, change the frequency and route of the medications you're on already before you're maybe adding or changing things to those medications, but like you're kind of playing around with the ones that you're on first to the nth degree that you can before you're adding. To replace electrolytes and nutritional deficiencies as much as you can. Again, that would probably be mostly through the IV to prevent or proactively manage any side effects that might be coming up from those medications. And then when you're done and you're going to wean, which is often for most people in the second trimester, you're going to wean over a period of 2 weeks in the second trimester after 2 weeks without symptoms. So you're going to wait until you're in the second trimester and you've not had symptoms anymore, because for a lot of women, it is primarily first trimester. And then you're going to still wean over a 2 week period. You're going to go slow. It's called Kimber's Rule of Twos. Again, you can find all of this stuff on the hyperemesis.org website. They just find that that is going to have the best progression off weaning yourself without rebound. And so then, yeah, some other things that you just mentioned, we acupuncture. So the most current research of acupuncture is with just regular nausea and vomiting of pregnancy and not true HG, but there's definitely going to be people who have benefit, and it's for sure worth it if you have that ability. Specifically, there's a point called P6. It's like on the inner wrist that can be helpful for a lot of people. You can look up a picture on how to stimulate that for yourself or just your regular nausea vomiting and see if that helps. But it's really tricky because, oh, go ahead. Do you have something to say?
I was just going to say, so when we talk about acupuncture, it's different than Chinese medicine herbs. So not all acupuncturists do Chinese medicine herbs. So you can't just go to your local acupuncturist who does the needles and does the points and be like, "Oh, I'm just going to take the herbs from them." Like typically the Chinese medicine herbs I'm talking about,
I see
they
what
have
you're saying.
much more training. They are learning something in a much more intense and deep way. A lot of them have like their doctorate in the actual Chinese medicine herbs, very different than just going to an acupuncturist who might sell some herbs in like a supplement, container at their practice. So it's very, very different. They usually blend them and make them specific to you. They're not like off the shelf and they are usually powder. They're very bitter. Like it's a completely different thing. So if you go to an acupuncturist, not all acupuncturists are trained in this way, even if they're like, "Oh yeah, I do herbs," like no, you want someone who is a specifically trained, custom Chinese medicine herbalist who has like lots and lots of experience. So that's what I mean as they're different.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I was kind of conglomerating those two in my mind. But so you have both potentially to your
Yes,
disposal. You
potentially both.
could
Yeah. And
find
like
somebody.
maybe acupuncture doesn't work. Like it never did for me. I tried so hard. Like the actual poking of the points, I did not ever try like the Chinese medicine herbs. I didn't know about that. Even though my acupuncturist probably did some herbs, it wasn't the same way as like a formulary Chinese medicine herbalist type of thing. So, yeah, they're different. But sometimes people do get a lot of benefit from just acupuncture. It
No,
can be
I'm
really
glad you brought
helpful.
that up because it's reminding me of my experience at PCOM, which is the acupuncture school in San Diego. And when we were students in the first year of school, I had battled chronic UTI since I was 3, because I would hold my pee and never wanted to stop playing. Totally tracks with my personality now. And I would then get a UTI, and then it's kind of like you get onto this cycle of antibiotics, and then you mess up your gut microbiome. I'd been on a million rounds of antibiotics already for ear infections as an infant, and then you get another UTI and whatever. Anyway, so I'd had many, many, many UTIs, and in my first year of school, I started going to PCOM, the school, and they did the traditional Chinese medicine herbs. And they made me the most disgusting, absolutely atrocious blend of herbs. And for about 6 months, I was on these herbs. And I have had maybe two UTIs in my life ever since. And that was when I was 23. 23. They like cured my chronic UTIs.
But
And I
that's
don't
what
know
I'm talking
what any
about.
of them were. I didn't recognize, they're all in Chinese. I had no idea, but I had to make these teas like 3 times a day and boil them, blah, 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 whatever, whatever. But it freaking worked, dude. I totally packed, like, forgot about that.
It can be like magic. So this is Lisa, our friend that we keep talking about. She is now working with him since she's had her two pregnancies, and he has told her very confidently that he would be able to lessen her nausea and vomiting in a subsequent pregnancy, that he does it all the time, and that she says that she's had the best health she's ever had working with him. So anyways, I'm going to start working with him, but that's just something I wish
Good.
I had known about, I know, before. And there's no guarantee that like you won't have it, but I do think that there's something off, right? Like this isn't normal. Something is off when the body is having such an extreme reaction to pregnancy. And sometimes the way that Chinese medicine works, it's sort of like homeopathy. It's kind of like magic, even though it's not. If we had the ability to study it, it's a symbiotic experience of all of these different things working together on your specific root cause of whatever that is very different than taking like a Zofran, because that's just working on a single agent thing and it's not getting to the root of what's actually going on. So I'm not saying that every person, can do this. There's definitely risks to taking certain herbs and things, but it's just, I want people to know that that's an option. And the acupuncturist here in Idaho, I think his Folkwise Herbal Medicine, I think is his name, or it's like Chinese Medicine of Idaho. Sean, I don't know. Anyways, shout out to
Okay.
him.
No, yeah. Thank you for saying that because it is different. I'm glad you, yeah. Yep. So you can look into that. Okay. Electrolytes. I mean, I know this sounds like dumb, but again, if there's a way to get them in orally or somehow your everything is going to suffer if we are in a constant electrolyte imbalance. Homeopathy, as we've mentioned, there is a link that will be in the show notes to my favorite homeopath's website, Jill Giesinger, and she does actually take clients too, and she specializes in women's health. So she would be a good person to contact if you wanted to work specifically with a homeopath. But she has a blog article that's just going to give you a general overview of the way that some of the top nausea and vomiting remedies would look in their picture so that you could at least become familiar, because that's the other thing with homeopathy. It's like you're learning an entire new language. And probably when you're in the state of constant, deep, deep, deep hungover feeling, you're not like trying to learn that. You know what I mean? So I get it. 50 milligrams of B1 daily. These are things that we would like add on if we could, if you were able to take things the way that we'd want them to. 25 to 50 milligrams of B6, 2 to 3 times a day. This is just like some random stuff here. Ginger, of course, can work early on, but it doesn't often work later. But you also need a higher dose. You need like 1.5 grams total in capsules split throughout the day. Some people, it's going to do literally nothing. Ginger has, it's going to be one of those gut kind of reasons. If your reason is not gut based, then this is going to do nothing for you. Okay, minimize odors and noise and like try, it's almost like you have a migraine or something. You know, your body is, you need to kind of keep the settings consistent and non-chaotic, and it's much more difficult to do that, obviously, if you have other children. Sometimes hypnosis can be helpful. Physical therapy consults to give you some exercise ideas to prevent atrophy of your muscles as you're going through this, and tons and tons and tons of empathy and finding people who believe you and will help you cope, because there's nothing worse than being gaslit in a situation like that where you're like not being believed. And another thing that we'll leave off here is that people don't really think about this. There's a whole recovery to postpartum, or sorry, to hyperemesis in your postpartum time because of how much you were not able to nutrient or to, you know, feed yourself and nourish yourself in that time period. So it can take at least 4 to 6 months expected of a really intentional recovery program, if not years, to replace some of the damage done from these nutrient deficiencies. There may be like vague immune changes or GI symptom changes or different things like that lasting for years, but there may not be. You may not notice, or at least not connect. But sometimes food aversions can persist and take months or even years to resolve because it gets a little psychological. Repleting nutrients takes lots of time just in general, like, you know, if, especially if you're breastfeeding. And I mean, a normal pregnancy takes a long time to replete nutrients, right? But like, imagine now you went through a pregnancy where you didn't eat anything. Okay. And then, as I said, yeah, if you are breastfeeding, it's going to take even more. So some of the recovery issues that people who've had HG might notice, just in case you're like, well, what would I even be looking for? You could have a stomach bacterial imbalance. So you have a dysbiosis. Maybe you have an infection. Maybe you got or had an H. pylori infection. Stomach ulcers or damage, throat damage, like esophageal damage because of the bile and the vomiting. Tooth damage again from the enamel. You could have a higher cavity rate, which is already something that sometimes pregnant women who aren't vomiting all the time deal with. You could even have some like tooth loss kind of things. Low bone density due to the malnutrition. Maybe you need to get a DEXA scan. Some gallbladder issues with stones or sludge, malnutrition in general, anxiety or depression or trauma from the situation, and then like the muscle loss, weakness, things like that, and then any residual nausea or food aversions, which at that point are then usually considered to be a psychological after effect and not because of this continued, GDF-15 or even gastric dysfunction necessarily. But so some of that can last. It's not like, oh, it's just the baby's out and everything's fine. Although a lot of people will feel symptom relief pretty much as soon as baby and placenta are born. There just takes a little bit more intention in your recovery. So just make sure that you're considering that. And
Amazing.
that's all I have for you guys. I wish I had some more of like a magic wand, but the purpose of this episode is just to give you like a really good overview of it and some ideas and some normalization, some validation. If you've experienced it in the past or if you're experiencing it now, and just like huge hugs to anybody who's been affected by this because it is no joke.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing all of that. And yes, sending so much love and validation to anyone who is experiencing this. And if you know of anyone who's going through it, please, please up your empathy and your care and your love for them.
Yeah, and share this with them because maybe they will learn something that they maybe, and there's probably certain personality types who aren't even really admitting it to themselves that they really do need help.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you. Are you pregnant or you're trying to conceive and you're looking for reliable natural health information about how to have a healthy pregnancy and also prepare for the future steps in motherhood to come, like the birth, the breastfeeding, and the postpartum? Because I have got you. So this is exactly the reason why I made the 6-week pregnancy call. And it's my most comprehensive resource. It's the thing that I absolutely love. I've poured my heart and soul into it. It's all of the things that I wish that every woman knew when they are entering motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 class, and a postpartum planning course all in one. And normally I run it as a class with live Q&A calls, but now it's available in a content-only format so that you can purchase it at any time and start learning immediately. It's called the lessons-only format, and it is just only all of the video lessons that you'll get access to for forever. So log on to milkmedicine.com/lessons-only or check out the link in the show notes.
In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.